Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the United Malt Group Interim Results Conference Call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Mark Palmerquest, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for attending our half-year 2021 results presentation. For an agenda today, I'm just going to walk through some highlights and then talk about our transformation strategy that we had referred to back in February. And then I'm going to have Amy Spanik, our CFO, just go through first half 21 performance. And then I'll come back and talk about strategy and outlook. And from there, then we can do a question and answer session. So I'm going to go to page four of the presentation and just go through the highlights. So for first half 21 results, we actually delivered slightly ahead of our AGM commentary. And that was really a result of we're a little bit ahead of some shipments that came forward in March that we're expecting in April. And also some of our transformation costs actually bled into April, so it wasn't quite the same amount in March. So for the half year, our EBITDA was $52.7 million, which includes the one-off items and the FX translation that Amy will go through later in the presentation. Which brings us to an operating cash flow, which was positive, approximately $22 million for the first half year. So in business, we've been focused on a number of things. And since March 2021, our volume is tracking at about 95% of pre-COVID-19 levels. It's just really highlighting the resilient business model that we have that has allowed us to be prepared for that increase in shipments that we've seen coming forward. We're tracking slightly behind pre-COVID levels, and until we get the large social gatherings and big events opening up and more relaxation, we would anticipate that that will continue. Our transformation commenced in the beginning of the second half of FY21. And we're targeting 30 million annualized net benefits by fiscal year 24, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Also just want to highlight that our recordable injury frequency rate improved by 37%, and I'll look at that on the next slide. From a capital management aspect, our net debt to EBITDA is sitting at 2.4 times, which is within the target range that our board has established of 2 to 2.5 times. We always are seasonally high right about this time period, so we're definitely in range and we'll stay in range through fiscal year 21. Our board has also approved and declared an interim dividend of 2 cents, which is a payout of 45% of NPAT. Our policy continues to be 60%, but with the uncertainty, the board felt it was prudent to sit at the 45 cents of NPAT, in other words, 2 cents. So moving on to the next page. I just want to highlight again on the safety aspect. As I mentioned, the RIFR improved by 37% from last year, and even compared to first half 19, it's a 10% improvement, and we're certainly proud of that and what our employees and our colleagues have done. We think a lot of it has to do with our leader engagements, which were prioritized with over 6,000 engagements completed during the first half of 21. Going to slide six, I want to start talking about the transformation strategy. And what we're working through is being united together. We want to come in and transform our business and renew our organizational and technological platforms to create a more simplified, more efficient, and effective organization. And we're doing this after conducting a global business assessment. We went in and looked across our whole global operations. We have identified some areas of focus and initiatives that we think will help us transform and grow our business into the future. And to make sure that we are measuring our progress, we've established a transformation office responsible for delivering the transformation outcomes. Again, we will measure the process and the progress, and we'll modify as we go on this journey. So going to page seven, this is our scorecard that we're looking at. We've got three areas that we're focused on. The first one is the organizational redesign. We want to come in and actually transition to a more simplified operation, to more pure play as standalone, fit-for-purpose malting company. And we are already restructuring, and we will continue to do that over the next year and a half to 2 years. We're going back and reviewing the opportunities that we can leverage our function strength that we have on a global basis, areas where we may be doing it better in one area inside of our entity, and ways that we can be able to learn from that and merge that together. We're also looking at a lot of process change. We want to improve our capabilities by implementing more simplified and standard processes throughout the organization, both from a skill set aspect, but also from a system aspect. The whole point is we want to become more data-informed in our decision-making. So today we've got technology platforms that have been scoped, and our process is now underway, from ERPs to transportation management systems to warehouse management systems. And then we're also focusing on our operational management. We just want to harness the network of our malting production facilities and our warehouse and distribution centers so that we look at them as more of a one global network to deliver better outcomes for our customers. And we have programs that are already underway. We're looking at enhancing our cult management. And really what that is about is focused on the customer and taking our capabilities with their multiple locations and optimizing landing costs and what we can do with our products as well. We're focused on improving our manufacturing and freight excellence. Certainly the systems that I just referred to will help with that, but it's really focused on our skill sets and our processes. So we want to enhance our global procurement. We're an organization that operates in many different countries, and the abilities that we have to look at what we're doing on a procurement aspect and maximize our results. So with all of this going on, we're targeting $30 million in annualized net transformation benefits by fiscal year 24. I'm going to hand it over to Amy Spanik and let her walk through the first half 21 performance review.
Thank you, Mark. Across the geographies, we're starting to see an emergence from the lockdown, primarily in the U.S. and in the U.K. We're seeing relaxation of restrictions, such as moving to outdoor dining, but these vary state by state and country by country. We are seeing increasing rates of vaccinations, which should help to enable further restrictions and lockdown, further reductions of these lockdown provisions. But we are also seeing an experience of a third wave of COVID in Canada. In the next slide, we are continuing to see that COVID has had an impact on our volume and our mix, reflecting that continued shift from the on to off premise. We're seeing positive trends as consumers trade up to more premium products, and the brewing industry itself continues to innovate and respond to the change in the consumer's patterns. We continue to see the emerging impact of shortages of bottles and cans within our supply chain, and the continued disruption of the freight containers that we've discussed previously in Australia and Canada, but now also having some impact on imports in the U.S. The one point that actually is a very positive one for us is that the distillers continue to focus on that longer-term horizon with laying down spirits for over 10 years, and that has been a positive trend for us. As I go to the next slide for the first half results, it's worth noting that in the period of 31 March, it includes the full impact of COVID compared to prior year, which was essentially a pre-COVID, and we were still under GrainCorp period. The COVID impact of the volume and mix has resulted in our revenue being down about 11%. But looking at it from a constant currency perspective, revenue is down about 4%. We see that that has been impacted by the headwinds of the FX translations and some of the one-off costs that we've encountered, and the fact that we now have corporate costs in the first half not previously experienced. Our EBITDA of $52.7 million is slightly ahead of range, and that is something that I will talk about in the next slide. NPAT was $13.2 million, reflecting that lower EBITDA, but it was partially offset by lower net finance costs as a result of lower interest rates and also a lower tax expense for us. Moving on to the next slide with the earnings waterfall, we want to be able to show you those movements from the half year of 2020 to 2021. There was a one-time item that occurred in the first half of 2020, which was not recurring this year, being the HOPS write-off of the $2.8 million. We've talked a little bit about the functional currency, the currency translation impact that we are experiencing of $6.3 million. And just to give a bit of reference, the USD to Aussie conversion was 67 cents last half compared to 75 cents this half. We also note that there is the impact of our standalone costs, as we called out previously, the AGM, which was not in our prior year, and as we were still part of Green Court. We're seeing from a COVID impact perspective a bit of an uplift that is on a temporary basis, and this is related to mainly travel, meals, and entertainment. As we are comparing to the prior year, which was pre-COVID, we are not expecting that when things open back up that we will be able to maintain all of these savings. You can see that there was a significant impact of about $6.9 million that we are experiencing from a volume and a mix perspective, much having to do with the difference that we recognize between base malt margins and those received with specialty malts. We do continue to see a negative impact on costs due to hygiene and social distancing related with COVID-19, and you can then see the impact of the container disruption of the $2.2 million. One of the benefits that we are seeing has to do with the results of some of the optimization programs that were started on our warehouse and distribution side of the business, started in the prior year, that are coming into account in this year. Net of some of the costs in implementing that, we're seeing an uplift of about $1.3 million. This brings us to an EBITDA of 60.1 before the one-offs that we have talked about previously, being the Grantham closure of the 3.1 and the transformation costs of 4.3 for a net result of $52.7 million EBITDA. As I go to the next slide and talk about the processing side of our business, you'll see that revenue is down about 11%. Once again, on a constant currency basis, that would have been about 5%. Our EBITDA being down 37%, and our EBITDA margin was about 8.6. But if we were to exclude those one-off items as discussed previously, we would only be down 26%, and our margins would have actually had a resulting percent of 10.1. The main impacts were the volume and mix, along with increased costs, again, of maintaining COVID-safe operations for our employees. The last item of note that I would want to mention with regard to our processing segment is the negative translation impact of about $5 million. Moving to warehouse and distribution, we've seen improvements in this area of our business despite the impact of COVID-19. Though our revenue was down 11%, with constant currency it's only 2%, and our EBITDA is actually up 12%, reflecting improved volume and mix in the craft brewing industry as our order frequency is beginning to return with increases in off-premise supply, and also seeing some reopenings in late February and early March. We're also benefiting again from that optimization program and those freight initiatives mentioned with the previous slide. When we look at the EBITDA margin for this half, it's 11.9%. Even when we are taking into consideration the one-off for the hops in the prior year, where that amount was 9.4%, without the hops, it would have been 11.1. So we are beginning to see that positive impact in our EBITDA margin happier to happier. In going to the next slide, page 15, the balance sheet indicator slide. Our working capital continues to be in line with the seasonal requirements, where we have the high point at our half year and our low point at year end. We have not seen an increase in doubtful debts related to the COVID-19, and our gearing does remain in the range of 2 to 2 times. We currently have no long-term debt facilities that are maturing until 2022, and so that we are not concerned with having to do any near-term refinancing. As we go to operating cash flows, we do remain cash flow positive, generating just over $22 million in our operating cash flow, and much of that reflects the timing of grower payments that we experienced in the first half. We continue to see lower interest paid with the lower interest rates that we're experiencing, but we did experience higher taxes paid in the first half. The other items line includes items such as our derivative mark-to-market, our movements in provisions, movements in our pension liabilities, and prepayments, which for us oftentimes are including insurance. And finally, as I move to the last slide of capital expenditures, we are continuing with our strategic priorities, including the expansion of our Scottish facilities and our Perth kiln upgrade, along with other smaller growth key initiative projects. These growth projects represent about 80% of our overall CapEx spend, and with these projects, we do expect to generate returns over the medium term. In saying that, our CapEx guidance does remain unchanged at about $120 million. And with that, I hand it back to Mark.
Thanks, Amy. Appreciate that. I'm going to go to slide 19 and just talk about some of our strategic priorities. And we have them grouped in three areas. And the first one is optimizing our core. And a part of what we're involved in right now is the Scottish distilling expansion. We've finished up the Arbroath facility. It's fully commissioned and it's operating at the target capacity, and the volume is fully sold out. We continue to work on our Inverness facility, and that's on track to complete by May 2022. And we expect the overall project returns to maintain our 12% IRR hurdle rate. We've started our expansion and penetration in the Mexican market. We have expanded our distribution agreement with our existing Mexican distribution partner. And we have our first additional warehouse that is being prepared, and we expect to be open in June 2021. And we are presently stocking some products down into that warehouse. We also are getting ready for our new warehouse and distribution center in Victoria. We're on track. That should open up on 1 June 2021. And it's going to replace an existing external warehouse that we've been using, so that we can get better control of not just our product, but as importantly, the one-stop shop experience for our customers that has been very influential in what we've used in the U.S. Combining products of both cold and ambient, room ambient temperature products, be it hops, malt, and other products. The second area is transforming for tomorrow, and I've talked about the transformation priorities that we've identified, and the timing and the targets that we have established. And again, the details are back on slide 7. And our replacement of the Perth kiln is well underway, scheduled to complete in October 21. It certainly is going to be beneficial for us in reduction in energy usage, reduction in emissions as well, and improvement in safety. And then the final area is just creating new value. So one is we're really looking at new product development. We are working on that. As many of you know, the hard seltzer market and also the AVIPA category in beers has been growing at some pretty astounding rates in North America and now also in Australia. And we have increased our offerings for those type of supplies. We've had a 28% increase on these ancillary type of products. We're also working our Malt Innovation Center with our brewers on the alcohol-free beers category, which has also been growing as well, and helping them with flavor profiles and certainly at what levels of malt inclusion needs to be in there. And we're also investing in further malt and ingredient processing for the food and beverage applications. Malt products are very good in bread products, any place that needs increases in protein, soluble fiber, and also works very well as a natural sweetener. And then we're also proactively assessing any type of acquisitive growth opportunities that are out there, anything that can extend our geographic reach, our product offerings, our customer base, that certainly can provide an increase in value for us. Also wanted to touch on our commitment to operating a sustainable business on slide 20. And I'm sure you've all seen our inaugural sustainability report that we released last year. We are working very hard in developing and expanding our sustainability strategies so we can address the key areas of risks and opportunities that present itself in a sustainable way. We certainly are committed to promoting a diverse and inclusive workplace, but we are very focused on reducing environmental impact, managing such things as water and energy, which we are a big consumer of, and reducing our emissions. The benefits are mutual. They typically provide great efficiencies inside of our business, but certainly are beneficial to the environment and in the communities that we operate in. So just to touch on COVID-19 and look forward dates, we certainly are developing kind of a rising optimism in what's happening out here. That's really on a number of fronts for us. One is we're seeing medical advances on being able to treat and manage the virus and the variants. And as each month goes by, the whole health community is becoming more effective in being able to do that. For us, the Northern Hemisphere, spring summer approaches is important. Just as a reminder, in North America, it's about 60% of our business. And certainly this supports this aspect of more outdoor type of dining, and we think it supports a recovery that was similar to what we experienced last year. And certainly the vaccinations are underway and ramping up. Availability is expanding into other countries, and the rate take up in a lot of the areas that we operate in is certainly encouraging for us. So we see there is some pent-up demand for beer, and we expect to see that rebound coming in brewing volumes. And again, as we've said since March, we've seen our shipments on malt and other products pick up. So upon reopening, we are expecting the entire hospitality pipeline should replenish. But again, you know, the issue about the mass gathering, big venue events is the ones that we'll keep our eyes on in the future. So also for us in the second half of 21, you know, we certainly remain somewhat cautious in the near term, but I call it cautious optimism. We're certainly expecting that we're going to have to deal with some level of COVID-19 restrictions as we see it rolling through different areas that we operate in around the world. But we're also expecting that some of the relaxations will certainly benefit us on our volume aspects. We expect our volume, again, to remain somewhat below pre-COVID-19 levels. We really do need to get the big social gatherings, the mass gatherings, you know, including the sporting events, concerts, and travel, to really pick ourselves back up to the pre-COVID-19 levels. We certainly are working with our customers to navigate the fluctuation of demand supply, and we are certainly experiencing some shortages in certain areas. We're experiencing some transportation issues. And so those are the things that we are really trying to work through. And as Amy mentioned, we still have the same container disruption in a number of places around the world. And as we've said in the past, we're just reconfirming corporate costs expectations to be at $12 million for full year fiscal 21. As Amy said, our CapEx is expected to be $120 million for the full year. We are managing some of those inflationary pressures, and we are experiencing some of those delays in our construction projects and getting materials, but so far we're able to work through all of that. And with all that, we expect the gearing to be inside of the policy the board set for us at 2 to 2.5 times. So in summary, our half-year 21 results certainly did reflect the second wave that we experienced in a lot of our core geographical areas that we operate in. But we did remain profitable, cash flow positive, our balance sheet is strong, so we can definitely withstand the continued uncertainty and the duration that we have in COVID-19. As I've mentioned before, we are seeing signs of reopening coming in some of our key markets, and it's really good to see. However, we remain prepared for as restrictions come on and roll off, that we've got the flexibility to be able to move our product around and really supply the demand that we see coming out of our customers. And since March of 2021, our volume is tracking at 95%, so definitely an improvement from where we were as we're getting into the last half of the first half of 21. I know it sounds confusing, but for us, that's that kind of latter part of December, January, February, and where we really felt the full brunt of that second wave and third wave of COVID-19. So in conclusion, we're well placed to return to growth once we get the conditions to stabilize, and we're well in position that we can have that flexibility depending upon where the restrictions are coming in. We continue to operate in very good markets. Our assets are located in good strategic locations for us. Our distribution platform is certainly market leading. We've got our high quality customer base, diversified by our products and markets and our geographies. So it really helps us with that diversification as we're operating with the variances that go on with COVID-19. And we are on progress, and we are really working hard to deliver that transformation program and targeting $30 million in annualized net benefits by fiscal year 24. So with that, I appreciate you all listening to what we had to say, and we're ready to handle questions and answers.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Grant Saligari with Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Mark, Amy. Thanks for the opportunity. Look forward to seeing you face-to-face sometime in the near future. Question for you, if I could, Amy, just a slightly detailed one to start with, on slide 26, where you have the balance sheet in constant currency. So can I just confirm those 30 September and 31st of March constant currency figures are reflective of the currency at 31st of March 21? Is that the right way to interpret that?
Yes, that is correct.
And so just a quick couple of clarification questions. It's the basically the trade and other receivables are sort of flat 31st of March 21 on 31st of March 20 in constant currency terms. Is there anything there? I mean, to me, that might suggest, you know, either a late pickup in sales during the period, which boosts the receivables, or some extension of terms. I just wanted to clarify what was happening there.
You are certainly on the right track. We had a fairly slow beginning for our first half of 21, with a pretty significant pickup in order to be able to get the results that we did at the end of February and into March. And that is where we had that gain in the receivable balance, so that it is not too variant from that timing from March of last year.
Okay. All right. So that makes sense. That's reflective of the sales pickup towards the end of the period. A second question I had, and again, sorry, it's probably a dumb clarification question on my part, but what in your net debt to EBITDA calculation, you've defined it as EBITDA pre, you know, the AASB 16 impacts, and it's balance sheet debt excluding leases. Can you tell me, what's the actual rolling 12-month EBITDA figure you're using in that calculation? I just had a bit of trouble reconciling that.
So what we use is we use the net profit after tax. We put the tax back in, the interest excluding the lease accounting and the depreciation and amortization excluding the lease accounting. And for the first half of 2021, it's about $14
million. Okay. All right. Thank you. And do you have the second half of 20 figure in front of you, or can I follow up on that?
I don't have that in front of me, but we can get it for you.
Okay. All right. Thanks. That's the clarification question. Just back on the result of the transformation initiatives, Mark. I guess a question with the transformation. What line of sight do you have on, the achievability of, and I guess the quantification of those initiatives? I mean, how much detailed work, how much progress down the detailed track you've been able to do to sort of validate that $30 million figure? Any color you could provide on that, I think, would be helpful.
Yeah, and I appreciate the question, Grant. Obviously, we're still working through that, but what the comment that I would make is that $30 million, we think, is going to be pretty consistent each year. So you kind of look at it as a proration base on how we get to that $30 million. And if I look at the three categories, it's easier for us to see some of that process change because we can see what the systems work, technology work, transportation, those type of things that will really come through. On the first category, the big issue for us is, as we work through it, is really getting a lot of what we refer to as kind of account management aspects of things. It's working through changes that we make in terms of how we go to market, changes that we make in terms of how we're optimizing and supplying our customers. We need to take more advantage of the multiple locations that we have that can optimize the supply chain aspect as well as production and as well as barley prices that are in the marketplace. So those are the areas that we're working through. I think as we get into, because we're starting to execute it now, as we get into FY22, we're going to be able to provide more color on it, actually better provide more results on it so that we can give you what the progress is and go forward.
And should we expect that to be sort of back-end weighted in terms of delivery of the 30, or should we think that it's going to be fairly evenly spread between 22 and 24?
No, I think it'll be fairly evenly spread. So the components that we work on in 22, we'll see results that will be benefits in 22, and then we'll be able to work off of those and actually improve the benefits then in 23 and then into 24. So some of the things that cascade through there, obviously the technology systems are not all available in 22. We'll be working on those. And so we'll be changing processes as we go forward in that time frame, and then there'll be another tranche of benefits that will come in as those systems are being available for us to use. So that's kind of the cascading effect that we'll have as we go through it. So that's why the benefits are not all back-end loaded and showing up in FY24. There's a lot that we can do in 22 and 23 that actually gets us there. So as we have Melissa look at the organizational redesign as an example, we think it will simplify how we run our business. So we'll have some costs that we'll have to work through in 22, but then again, then those costs will be gone, but the benefits will still be there in 23. So that's the cascading effect, and that's why we do think it's going to be pretty consistent, prorated through each year in that three-year process.
Okay. And finally, any material CapEx associated with that? Or
No, outside of the technology platform, that would be the main component of it. Most of what we're seeing that we're going to do through the transformation is not a big capital spend at any size.
Okay, thanks. That's it for me. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Grant.
Thank you. Your next question comes from James Ferrier with Wilsons. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark and Amy. Thanks for your time. First question's around the volume uplift you're seeing, sort of running 95% of pre-COVID levels versus 90% previously. I'm just wondering if you could add some colour to that trend of improvement, in particular around the product mix, to the extent that that's changing as part of that improved volume trajectory, and also comparing the warehouse and distribution segment to the processing segment. Is either or segment seeing the bulk of that uplift?
Yeah, thanks, James. I answered the first one. And what we saw in March was both alcohol, the big brewer and the craft side, were expanding their shipments. So what we saw was both base and specialty malts shipments increase. So the benefit of that is back to what Amy had talked about, the product and volume mix, is that volume was going up, but the mix is starting to improve. And that ties in well with your question on the warehouse distribution, is they've been kind of like the canary in the coal mine type of aspect. We actually saw warehouse distribution business pick up before we saw it in processing. So it was a good indication to us that business was starting to grow again. In other words, demand was starting to grow again, because most of the craft guys do not like to hold inventory. So it's not a restocking issue. It's basically built on the fact they opened and the demand was coming, and so they were coming back and reordering. So we're feeling more optimistic that we're going to work our way back to a more traditional type of product mix. It's going to take a while for us to get there, but we're certainly optimistic about it, because we're really starting to see the craft side of the business starting to pick up. And you can see it in the warehouse distribution numbers. To Amy's point, when she was talking through that, they actually started picking up, I would say, roughly 30 days in front of processing picking up, and that was a pretty optimistic sign for us.
Thanks. That's helpful color there. So just to clarify that, one of your last comments there, that the product mix is not back to pre-COVID levels. So you've sort of got overall volume still below pre-COVID, and your mix is still unfavorable versus pre-COVID.
Yeah, well, it's not back to pre-COVID, but it is definitely improving from where we were just 3 months earlier. So that's a good sign, and we would expect that to continue, again, because we're hitting the summer months. We're seeing a lot of the restrictions starting to come off and cascade through North America, with the exception of Canada at the moment. And so those are helpful signs, considering that the vast majority of our volume and warehouse distribution sits inside North America.
Yeah, okay. Second question then, and sort of building on what you've just said, if we can be optimistic for a moment and think about the unwinding of restrictions and improving demand, it looks like there's pretty low inventory levels through the industry, and not necessarily just finished product, but raw materials as well, and old crop barley. So I'm just wondering to what extent UMG has sufficient supply capacity to respond if you do see pretty sharp continued improvement in demand recovery in the next couple of months?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there is shortages of a lot of products and raw materials and disruptions in the supply chains. We're actually sitting, in a good position that we can meet that demand. We're close to where the barley is located. A lot of it is still stored on farm, and the vast majority of it we have contracted. So we do have the commitments in place. So with the ramp up that we're seeing in shipments, we actually feel that we're in a good position to be able to handle that. Granted, if we had any delays in harvest on the new crop coming up, it could create some temporary shortages in certain regions we're in. But so far, the crop is going in pretty well on time. And so at this point, we're not anticipating any of that.
Okay, great. And then last question for me. You mentioned barley. Barley prices have risen along with most of the soft commodities complex. How are you positioned to pass on that higher barley cost for the non-pass-through portion of your volumes?
Yeah, so our contracts are either reflect the new barley price as you price the long-term agreements, or it's reflected right in the price of the malt for spot quick shipment. And we run ourselves a fairly even, type of positions. We're not in the marketplace to make big bets on if we think the price of barley is going up or going down. So the risk in the prices going up a lot in barley is really taken on by our customer who is unpriced or hasn't purchased.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks, James.
Thank you. Your next question comes from David Pobucky with Macquarie Group. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Mark and Amy. Congratulations on the result. In terms of constant currency revenues in the first half, that they were down 4%. How did volumes track specifically in the period?
So that is where we are referencing that 95%. So from a pre-COVID perspective. So, and that is split fairly evenly between both our processing and our warehousing sides of the business.
Okay, so for the whole or on average over that period, you're at 95% pre-COVID levels. Is that how we should be thinking about it?
From a first half perspective, yes.
Yep. Okay, great. Thank you. And then I don't know if you're able to provide a bit more color on the momentum in volumes that was built month on month in March, April, and May, if that's possible.
David, what volumes are you referring to?
Processing and warehouse distribution. I'm just trying to understand the momentum that's being built over the last few months, from the period end till present.
Sure can. So as we were beginning the first half of the year, we were fairly positive with regards to our volume as we were coming out with our full year numbers. Then as we were going into the latter part of November into December and the beginning of calendar 21, just before AGM, we had seen a significant dip. It was not until late February going into March, and it has continued into April as well, that we were beginning to see that uplift in the volume. So that's where that average of that 95% comes in, and that is what we are hoping will continue, that as we go into the second half of our year, that it will still continue at least that rate. I mean, we would love if it were higher than that, but we don't have expectations that we will necessarily be able to maintain a pre-COVID through the second half by any means. The amounts that we had experienced on the two, I'll say, bookends of it, were somewhat obviously negated by that trough that we had in the middle.
Thanks, Amy. That's helpful. And just in terms of earnings seasonality, I think it's typically 40-60 between the first half and second half. Is there anything that stands out that would mean that traditional seasonality doesn't hold this year? I think you mentioned some shipments were pulled forward into March from April.
Aside from some of that timing and that April aspect, we are not seeing things that would change that expectation for us. Much to the point that Mark had indicated, we have the North American summer that we definitely would be experiencing that second half, along with in the UK as well. And so from what the assumptions are that we're using, that 40-60 split still remains a pretty good trend.
Exciting. And just one last one on corporate costs. There were $4 million in the first half, and then expected to be $8 million in the second half to get to guidance of $12 million. Why is the step up there between the first half and the second half?
Let me have a little bit of clarification there. So that $12 million actually includes some insurance costs that actually go out into our warehouse and distribution and our processing segments. So that full amount of additional costs that we would have through the year of the $12 million, while the corporate costs in the first half are 4.3, you can see from the waterfall that the uplift in comparison to the first half last year was closer to about $7 million. We have the indications that as we are going into the second half, that it will be that $12 million. So it is not just the corporate costs by itself, but it is insurance increases that we experienced that were in the processing and warehouse and distribution segments as well.
That's clear. Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Apoorv Sehgal with UBS. Please go ahead.
G'day, guys. Most of my questions have basically been answered. So I'll just ask one question if I can. Just with the sort of comments around pent-up demand that you're seeing as we head into the Northern Hemisphere summer period, is it realistically possible that beer volumes sort of through June, July could sort of be at or even above pre-COVID levels?
Well, we'll have to see. What I would tell you is I think a lot of the pickup that we're seeing in April, May is the aspect that on-premise consumption is increasing because of the relaxation of the restrictions. And so they're having to ramp up and produce beer so they can fill the kegs and get that distributed to what is called the hospitality sector. So that's in restaurants and other types of venues. And so for them, there's a big push that goes on. If that demand continues to be there, then they're going to come back and have to replenish the kegs that they have been filling. And I would just also say that we don't see a lot of restocking going on raw inventories either. So if the demand starts to actually improve in consumption of the beverage, then we could possibly see where the malt demand and shipments could increase in June, July. But we'll have to wait and see what that ends up being. I think the telltale sign for us is the more that we look at the April data, that we can then see if we think May is going to continue at that pace, and if it does, there should be a continuance of that demand for June, July. Possible that it could go up, but again, we're getting in the areas now trying to predict the uncertainty of how restrictions are coming on.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star one. Your next question comes from Mark Topi with Select Equities. Please go ahead.
Hello. Just a couple of questions there. Just firstly, in terms of the transformation savings gains, I'm wondering if you can just reference that to the competitive plane and any pressure you might see in terms of holding on to those cost savings and productivity gains as we go forward on that program.
Yeah, confidence that we'll be able to hold them, because our issues right now is not because we're uncompetitive in the marketplace. We think what we need to be doing is improving parts of our efficiencies, part of it is our decision making, optimizing ourselves in terms of logistics, where we're shipping to customers. We think we can improve the landed cost base. So we're pretty comfortable that these should be gains that we should be able to hold inside the company. If we're having problems being competitive in the market, I certainly wouldn't have that type of confidence. But we're operating, pretty full out. So the issue for us would be is we think we're competitive in the market, and if we added more capacity, then we'd have to take a look and see what that would turn out for us in terms of a margin base. But, I guess the easiest way I can answer to you, Mark, is we think we're performing well in the market. This is helping United Malt perform better for customers, but also better financially.
Okay, great. And you referenced the craft beer segment coming back. I just wonder with COVID whether you've seen structural changes in the marketplace. We've seen some of the bigger craft brewing companies really take share through this period. Do you think for people in Australia to understand in terms of that craft beer segment and the smaller microbrewers coming back in terms of market share. I guess my observation is that some of those craft brewing companies have been really taken share because they've been able to supply the retail chain, as we'd call it. So I'm just wondering, do you observe any permanent sort of structural changes in terms of the US craft beer market is my question.
And it's a great question. It's one that we look at almost daily just to see if there is any structural change. So today we can only give you a little bit of anecdotal types of observations, and that is in the areas where we see relaxation of restrictions, we see a very good comeback. So again, anecdotally, we'll see where this all goes, but as customers are able to go back and consume their local craft, it appears that they are indeed going back and doing that. So for us today, it looks like it's kind of an aberration that they are going back and doing that. The other thing that we're seeing out here is even through COVID, going through 2020, that there is actually a net increase of new craft microbrews in the U.S. So certainly we're closures, but there's net more openings through that whole period. So there still seems to be a demand that is there for that local, intimate type of specialization that's going on with these small craft producers. So time will tell. We'll have to see how this all goes. But everything we're saying today is that the consumer is coming back to those microbrews.
Great, okay. And if I recall correctly, is the D&O insurance has really been hyped up in terms of, while there's been insurance increases in rates right across the board, I'm just wondering on that trend on D&O insurance particularly, and has it stabilized or is it still increasing?
So the D&O market is still a hard market. We are not continuing at this point in time continuing to see the dramatic increases that we had seen at the end of last year. So we believe that what we are forecasting within our own budgets is enough to cover it, as we are not seeing it continue to harden, but it's not really softening, but it seems to have leveled out.
Right, okay, thank you. Just in terms of the cash management, could you just elaborate, while we've got the currency translation sort of impact, can you just talk us through just perhaps in terms of the cash management, how much cash you'd be repatriating to Australia, for instance, and in terms of the natural hedge as well? I'm just trying to understand, I suppose, the cash, and particularly against the backdrop of that currency depreciation, increase in the Australian dollar, just how you're managing the cash from a global perspective.
Sure. So we do not have hedges in place for the translation of the foreign currencies. The hedges that we do are on the transactions that are in foreign currencies for either purchase or sales contracts, or also with our interest rate hedges. We have some associated with that as well. But the actual translation of any of our foreign currencies into Aussie dollars is not part of the hedging program. So when we do that constant currency element, there is not a factor that is associated with any hedging.
So presumably there's natural hedging associated with the debt. I'm just trying to understand the cash movements, I suppose, if you can maybe talk to that a little bit more.
So we don't do much cash movement based on many of the projects for the strategic capital builds that we are doing. We are utilizing the cash in those locations.
And Mark, another point I'd make is, you know, our issue is making sure what the costs are that it takes for us to produce the malt is lining up with the currency and where we're making sales. So case in point would be as we produce a lot of malt in Canada, as an example, but we're selling in U.S. dollars. Or we produce malt in Australia and sell in either U.S. dollars, sometimes Japanese yen. So we're making sure that we're running hedges on those aspects so that we're not taking on the risk of currency and our costs and production are not lining up with what we're doing on sales.
Sure, and I suppose, you know, from Australian perspective, it sort of distorts the performance of the company, just the currency movements, I suppose, so that's what I was trying to get at. So just lastly, just to confirm, you mentioned Victoria, expansion of the warehouse. Is that Victoria, Australia taking, or?
Yeah, it's Victoria, Australia, and actually it's just sitting down in Melbourne. Just on the outside edge of it, at the west side. It's a nice location for us, and it's really dealing with the aspect that craft business continues to grow, that it really has brought us to a point where we really do need to do the one-stop shop as the craft, the brewers themselves are getting bigger, but also there's a very good distilling boutique business that is in that area as well. And so it's just really trying to improve what we're doing for our customers.
Great, because I'm based in Melbourne, so I'm excited to hear that expansion there in Melbourne. So, but thanks for your time and answering my questions then.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Richard Barwick with CLSA. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, Mark. Hi, Amy. Just want to pick up you on the comment you were talking about seeing a net increase in brew pubs in the US. Love it if you could provide some actual numbers there. And also, when you're talking that type of customer, I mean, where are you guys in terms of servicing them? Do you see yourselves as the sort of number one market share in servicing brew pubs, or who are the key competitors?
Yeah, we do believe that we are the leading supplier into the craft marketplace, Richard. There's one other competitor that's pretty close in our size, and then there's a pretty big drop-off. So we really do believe that we're staged in a very, very good position. I'm trying to recall the numbers because I just saw them. They came out of the BA Brewers Association that keeps track of that, and I just saw the numbers, and I just can't remember it off the top of my head, but I'm happy to send that to you so that you can see what the numbers are. I can tell you a little bit of percentages. That's pretty typical for the last number of years where you see more opening than closing. And in 2020, the spread was not as wide as you typically see it, but it was still a net gain of microbrews during the year. But I can get you the numbers.
Okay, thank you. And then are you able to give us a rough guide, really? I mean, how meaningful are these sort of microbrew or brew pubs in terms of earnings for the group?
My hesitation is making sure that it's not something we haven't disclosed before.
We don't generally go and disclose that depth of it. So
what I would say is that you know, it's roughly a third, and I think we've said that before. Actually, shown a pie chart that it ends up being roughly a third of what we do, and so it is meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And as importantly, it's also a business that ends up being, I would call, sticky with the customers.
Mm-hmm.
It's very uncommon for them to go back and forth and change with suppliers because, again, they're trying to produce a very unique profile of taste, appearance, mouthfeel. And so to change product is a big step for them to do.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And just... maybe it's a minor thing, but in the Aussie context, we note in the recent federal budget there was some benefits or some incentives provided to the craft brew industry. Is that, would you expect that to be impactful for United Malt, or is it just, you know, is it just too small to make a difference?
Well, you know, relative to the Australian business, it certainly is beneficial. Our concerns originally was where we're going to see a lot of microbrews go out of business. And Australia is in a nice position. Obviously, you've been in a different situation in terms of restrictions and COVID than most other areas, so good on you for that. But it's also we've seen a good domestic market. So that's where we've really seen improvements in terms of volumes, not enough to offset the drop in exports, which again is caused primarily by the supply chain disruptions, but also, you know, we're getting this second wave coming through a lot of the Asian countries. But it was good to see that there's acknowledgement that the microbrew are small businesses that typically are privately owned and owned by just a small group of people that have just been pouring their money and their lives into it. And so it was just a, it was really good to see that. It was a positive move by the Australian government.
Okay, and just to round that off on the Aussie side, if you're number one servicing that market in the US, what's the competitive context in Australia?
It's similar. There's two big players in the craft distribution business, and then there's a number of smaller players. So it kind of is working out in the same way as it is in the U.S.
With you guys being number one or number two?
It's close.
Okay.
It varies from year to year, and again, it's not just supplying malt, but it's also supplying hops, flavors.
Imagine there'd be regional SKUs as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from John Campbell with Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Hi guys, thanks for that. I appreciate the time. I know that we're probably getting near the end of the typical time for these calls, but just three quick questions, and if you have answered any of these, obviously just tell me. The first one on the working capital drawdown of about $53 million over the course of H1, do you expect that to largely reverse in H2?
So from a half-year to half-year perspective, that inventory amount does fluctuate a bit. We expect that there will be some reduction as we go into the second half with it, but we wouldn't expect it to decrease materially.
You wouldn't expect it to decrease materially?
When we compare to where we were at the end of our fiscal year last year. So if you look at our second half of 2020, we wouldn't expect it to, from an ending balance perspective, we wouldn't expect it to come down materially from that.
Right, okay. So we just reference FY20 closing balance, and that'll be an indication of where you think it'll end 21.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that, Amy. Second question for Mark, just around the organisational simplification, operational improvements that you're flagging for $30 million by FY24. Appreciate that these things take time, but you know, FY24 is a fair way out. Could you just explain, it sort of implies that there's the sense of urgency is not quite there, but can you just explain why that sort of elongated period for extracting those benefits?
Yeah, absolutely, John. So, again, we're not implying that it takes us to get to 24 before we'll see benefits, and it's 30 million. We'll actually see it happen in 22 and 23 as we go forward. So 22, a lot of it will be around some of the process change, organizational changes that we do. 23, we should have most of our systems in place, and so that's going to give us further benefits that come with that. And then through the whole three-year period, we'll be working on the operational management. So I certainly don't want you to think it's going to take us till 24 to get any benefits. We would look for benefits coming in 22 and 23 and then 24, and we think it's going to be pretty consistent of those benefits coming in that will add up to annualized basis of $30 million
in 2024. Right. So you're just calling out the $30 million as being completely there by FY24, but most of the benefits will flow well before then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Fair enough. Thanks for if there's any confusion, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. Good. That's great. Thank you for that. Just the last question in the interest of time. You briefly talked about seltzer, Mark, and I think there's a lot of, you know, the explosion in seltzer in North America, and I think there's a bit of confusion around about exactly what does this mean? And I know that it's not easy for you to quantify it, but in terms of the malt intensity of use in seltzer, could you just give us a feel for how you see that, and also whether you think seltzer is cannibalising beer or wine or both? Just overall, how you see it?
Yeah, and it is a good question. We're still sorting through it ourselves, and we also don't know what's going to happen once things open up. Seltzer is a very easy, portable, low-carb, low-sugar flavored drink, easy to produce. And that category is growing at a magnificent percentage base in North America, as well as now starting up in Australia. So the question of cannibalization, that's what we're looking at. And we think it's really, it's a new beverage category. So typically what happens is that you have some increase in overall consumption, but the cannibalization tends to come across all beverage categories. So some beer, some wine, ready to drink, some distilling. All of that is where seltzer is trying to fit its way in as it comes in the category. What you started out kind of the question is, some seltzer is produced with malt and has a malt inclusion, and it's considered kind of a premium type of product. But a lot of the seltzer is produced with any form of carbohydrate sugar that can actually convert to alcohol. So it can be dextrose, a lot of different types of products. It can be absolutely just straight granular sugar. It's a lot of things that can be used for that. We are supplying a lot of those products in our warehouse distribution. That's where we've seen the 28% growth in our ancillary products that we have going through it. So it's probably somewhat negative from a processing side because it could be taking away a little bit of malt usage. On the other hand, it is beneficial to the warehouse distribution side because we're well situated to actually provide a lot of those products.
Okay, that's a great answer. Thank you for that, Mark.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Belinda Moore with Morgans. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark and Amy. Just a few points of clarification, please. The $30 million, can I check that's the Aussie dollar, it's not US dollar? And in essence, I suppose what you're saying today is the outcome in the second half 21, is it sort of neutral, you know, benefits outweigh the cost, but then 22, 23, 24, we sort of see roughly sort of $10 million per annum of benefits. Then can I also check what sort of, I mean, CapEx, or I think it's got to be expense now under the new accounting standards, what sort of cost is it around for all the IT? And then, Amy, are you sort of targeting, you sort of, you know, your 80% type cash flow conversions you've had through the cycle? And then lastly, just on your sort of 40-60 split, are you backing out sort of, all the one-off costs in that assumption? Thank you.
Well, hi, Belinda. Let's see if I can remember all that. So I'll start with the $30 million is in Aussie dollars. And we do expect the benefits to be pretty consistent in those 3 years. So you're right, 21 is pretty much a neutral aspect. And as we've said, that the benefits that we are receiving in 21 is basically offsetting the costs that we're going through. Then you'll see benefits net coming in 22, 23, and 24. So you are right in terms of looking at that. In terms of the spend on the systems aspect, mm-hmm. we haven't put that out, have we?
We have not.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
It's not overly material, particularly when you compare it with the other growth projects that we have.
Yeah. Let me take that under consideration, Belinda, as we're going forward here. That may be an answer that we need to provide at the full year results. Let me think about that. We'll certainly have that number pinned a little bit better at that point as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm missing one.
I think the rest were for Amy. The 60-40 split. Cash flow conversion, please.
Yes. So we are still anticipating that we will do that 40-60 split, first half, second half trend, and that,
the cash conversion, while we're hoping to get back up to those pre-COVID levels that are that high, we're not expecting that we're going to be able to do it in this current year, just based on the way that we have not only the impacts of COVID that we are still working through, but also the continuation of the capital program that we have in flight.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Jonathan Snape with Bell Potter Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Look, just want to ask a couple of questions. I'm trying to waterfall the second half, kind of like you have on the first half. I want to check a couple of numbers and just make sure I heard them right. Did you say that the volumes on average through the first half were running at 95% of pre-COVID levels? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, you heard that right, Jonathan. So as Amy is talking about, as we started off in the year, which would have been 1 October, we started October, most of November, that we were actually running at levels that were close to pre-COVID type of levels. And then we hit that second wave, and they dropped dramatically in December and January and first half February. And then they pick back up again latter part of Feb and March. So it really is that barbell, as Amy describes it, in where we were sitting at close to COVID levels on the beginning and the end, but we had that big drop in the middle. So that's the part that produces it at something that was pretty close to 95% for the first half.
Okay, so by the same, I guess, token, if I looked at the constant currency numbers for processing, I think in the second half last year, they were down kind of about 11%. So I think memory serves me, you must have run at about an average then of 90% in the second half of last year. Would that be an accurate comment? Because I remember you put a chart up that was quite confusing back then, but it seems it would kind of average out to that.
Yeah, I think you're pretty accurate. So it was about 90%. The difference that we have this year is the months that we've got in front of us. And April was a very difficult month for us in FY20, and the first half of May was difficult. Conversely, this year we're running a strong April and a strong May. So the only question we have is we finished strong in FY20. For August, September were actually very good volumes. And to date, we're not in a position to actually predict what we think that would be. So our intentions are that we would run as well as we ran last year, and we would hope we'd actually continue where we're going April, May, that we'd actually run slightly better.
Okay. So I think if I'm hearing right, you've continued to run at that 95% through the first 2 months. You hope to get up higher by the back end. So if I'm thinking about numbers, I think last year it was about a $21 million impact, that 10% hit on volume and on mix. So if you're at 95, you should at least get half of that back. Would be kind of fair to say, if not a bit more. I think last year you had about $4.4 million of government support payments that you got in the second half that I suspect you probably won't get this year if that's what the volumes are looking for. And if currency was like $6 million in the first half, it's probably a bit higher than in the second half, like probably creeping up closer to $8 million if we're looking at $1 at 77 or 78 and where it sits.
Yep.
So with corporate, I'm kind of getting that this may be, you know, 13, 15 million bucks of headwinds year on year in currency, corporate, and non-recurrence of those government payments, and anywhere from 50 to 100%, I suppose, of that 21 million coming back. Is that kind of, I guess, how you would crudely back of the envelope it?
That's a lot of numbers. So it's, I think the comments you're making kind of sets what are the issues that we have going into the last half. So you know, you talk about where the currency exchange is. You're right if that's where you think it is, that it looks like it's pushing closer to 80, and that would be the same impact. Mm-hmm. You're right about the fact that we will not be participating in any government programs. So you're right about that. And so then it does comes down to a little bit of that volume index and trying to see where that all goes. Amy?
And there is one other item. We also did a big cost-cutting push on a temporary basis in the second half of last year that is not expecting to be reoccurring, and that was one of the elements being with reduction in salaries and such for employees, and that went all the way through actually to our board members for a period of time as well. That is not reoccurring this fiscal year.
Okay. So I guess that it's almost like a wash then year on year. Does that, like, you know, the headwinds kind of offset the tailwinds if you're at, you know, 50-75% or, you know, 95-97% utilization?
So there's not a way I would put it here, because I'm getting careful because I'm not trying to put out a four-year forecast.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we have similar things that are moving. The timing could be a little bit different, and the big uncertainty we have is that do we, again, get the big venues opened up that can allow us to operate at a higher volume level than how we're looking at things today or how we did in FY20. So how does that go into that whole mix, the numbers you just walked through, Jonathan, versus the offset that come in? So it's, I'm going to have to stay away from trying to give you a full
year. Okay. No worries. Can I just ask one question about the pivot as well? I mean, it looks like you pivoted pretty well on a lot of your volume mix, in terms of finding new customers or expanding with existing customers in that mainstream part. How easy is it to pivot away from those customers again when the craft side of the equation comes back, or do you sit down with them and start to talk about margins a little bit harder?
Yeah, the specialty business on the craft side tends to be a better margin business for us. So that would be the financial reasons for doing that. The other reason is that we want to keep supporting that growth and the customers that are in that business, because it's an aspect of it's not just the malt, it's all the other services in the warehouse and distribution. So it ends up being, I would just say, more additive to us in terms of services and products that we can provide. So that's the right mix for us. So until we had a meaningful add-on capacity in the U.S., it's making those type of decisions. So I appreciate it. You know what I say, Jonathan, we're kind of running a little long here, but by all means, if you got any other questions, you know, please follow up with Renee and we'll be happy to try to answer them.
Great. You couldn't make a comment about there was, I think, a subsequent event note in there that talked about one of your suppliers in the UK filing for insolvency. And it obviously reads like it's not a big deal. What proportion of your barley inventories would have they accounted for?
We haven't disclosed it, but it's not a meaningful amount.
Okay.
And again, we have title to that barley. So, you know, at least what we know today, we're not anticipating any meaningful impact, and it's not a big amount of inventory relative to what we use.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you. Appreciate that. And again, we appreciate everybody in attendance. It's been quite a 6 months for everybody in terms of what we walked through. But, you know, I just close in saying that we are certainly have some cautious optimism in terms of where we see the business going, the opportunity to open up. And, again, we think we're well positioned. So thank you very much for taking part of your day to spend it with us.
That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.